this rather cool day. First case, United States v. Smith. Is the appellant ready to argue? Thank you. The government? Thank you. Appellant may argue.
Good morning, Chief Judge, members of the court. I'm reminded the last time I appeared before the court was at Cornell University. The weather was pretty much the same thing. So I'm hoping that my next argument will be in the spring or the fall. Members of the court, by way of introduction, Judge Maggs, I don't believe I have the privilege of meeting you. My name is William Casera, and along with Major Julie Borchers, we represent the appellant in this case, Warrant Officer 1, Graham Smith. I'm glad I got that part out of the way. The first two times I introduced myself or introduced herself, I demoted her to captain, so I didn't want to do that again. Your Honors, as the court is aware, we are here to argue to discuss two issues before the court, and I will take them in chronological order, or in the order that they were granted. The first one is that the military judge abused her discretion in denying a defense motion to suppress evidence obtained from the appellant's cellular telephone because access to the contents of the iPhone would not have been available but for the government's illegal search, and the good faith doctrine would be inapplicable under these circumstances. As this court is aware, the military judge's conclusions of law are reviewed de novo, and the findings of fact are reviewed for clear error. If an error is of constitutional dimension, the burden is on the government to show that the evidence was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. I'm going to take these, again, as in the order I addressed them in the brief. The first issue is that Investigator Kessler failed to provide a sufficient nexus between the items seized, or the items sought, excuse me, and the alleged wrongdoing. And as this court is aware, in U.S. v. Nieto, this court said that a sufficient nexus must be shown to exist between the crime and the items to be seized. In this case, the only evidence that Investigator Kessler had at the time of the search authorization was a locked iPhone. The agent said in his affidavit that there was reason to believe any pictures taken with the iPhone have been synchronized wirelessly with the iCloud, allowing them to be synchronized with all Apple products and linked to Smith's account. It's important to know a couple of things, Your Honors, from a factual standpoint. At the time he requested the search authorization, Investigator Kessler had no information regarding the phone settings. He had no information whether the phone was synced to other devices. In fact, he had no information if the appellant even had other devices. And he had no information whether any photos even existed on the phone. The only nexus linking the iPhone to the items later seized was the investigator's generalized opinion, which was that pictures taken with an iPhone had been synced with other devices via the cloud, for which there was no factual support. As this court ruled in United States versus Clayton, speculation what a phone can do, as opposed to what a particular phone did do, is not a fair probability that contraband or evidence of a crime will be found in a particular place. The government has conceded that the magistrate in this case did not have a substantial basis for probable cause. The appellant would argue that this necessarily means that the affidavit was facially deficient because neither the facts stated therein nor any inferences drawn therefrom supported a finding of probable cause. Without an evidentiary nexus, the investigator's reliance on the warrant was not objectively reasonable. Thus, the good faith exception is inapplicable. By conceding that the magistrate did not have a substantial basis for a finding of probable cause, the government has tacitly conceded that the agent did not have a substantial basis for relying on the search authorization. The good faith exception is outlined in military rule of evidence. Judge.
Could you explain that last point?
Yes, Your Honor. The government has said that the magistrate did not have a substantial basis for a finding of probable cause. Since that magistrate's non-substantial basis was based on the magistrate's, the CID agent's affidavit, the appellant would argue that that is tacitly an admission that there was not a substantial basis for relying on the search authorization, and that the search authorization was, we would argue, facially deficient. The good faith exception is outlined in Military Rule of Evidence 311C3. While the court is aware, let me just very briefly summarize. 311C3A is that the search or the seizure resulted from authorization to search issued by a competent authority. We certainly have no qualm as to whether or not Major Farmer was a military magistrate. that the individual issuing the authorization had a substantial basis for determining the existence of probable cause, and that the executing official reasonably and with good faith relied on the issuance of the authorization. Good faith is determined, using an objective standard. This brings us obviously to the two cases arguably at question before this court, which are United States versus Carter and United States versus Hoffman. In United States versus Hoffman, this court said that the second prong of MRE 311 is satisfied if the executing officer had a substantial basis for determining the existence of probable cause. So 311C3B looks at the executing officer as opposed to the magistrate. In United States versus Hoffman, decided some 15 years later, this court said that the good faith exception does not apply where the issuing magistrate does not have a substantial basis for the existence of probable cause. I know that this court is going to hear next the case of United States versus Perkins, which will discuss any tension between Hoffman and Carter. We would argue that if there is tension between Hoffman and Carter, that Hoffman, the latter case, is the correct statement of the law. MRE 3...
Let me ask you this, yes, counsel. If your position is that Hoffman is the state of the law now, wouldn't it seem kind of odd that the court would dispense with a fairly critical case like Carter with kind of a two or three lines at the end of an opinion?
When you say a court, you mean this court?
This court. Okay. This court in Carter had a long recitation and description and explanation of why it was or how it was trying to reconcile Carter and Leon. And that seems to be a fairly significant and long-standing paradigm for analyzing the good faith exception, does it not?
It does.
And I guess to me, I'm wondering, wouldn't it seem odd for the court to simply cast that case aside and all of its progeny with, you know, two or three lines at the end of Hoffman?
And we don't. The appellant does not believe that this court needs to do so. Hmm. The appellant believes that Kaufman and Harder can peacefully coexist, although we would argue that Carter may require a little bit of explanation, for lack of a better term, which we believe Hoffman covers. We do not believe that this court has to overrule Carter in order to rule for the appellant. Mm-hmm. Our position is that if this court were to, I'm game playing in my own brain, if this court were to ask whether one overrules the other, we would argue that the latter case is the better statement of the law. But no, Your Honor, we do not believe that Carter has to be overruled.
Okay.
Counsel, could we back up to the nexus for a minute?
Yes, sir.
Why isn't it waived? It was raised for the – it wasn't raised below. Why isn't this waived?
Well, it's not – Your Honor, we agree with the government that it was not waived. We believe that there are two ways that this court can look at it. I mean, waiver is the known relinquishment.
We know that.
And I think that it would be oxymoronic for the appellant's counsel below to have objected to the search and the scope of the search and not have and intentionally waived any objection to the nexus. But we would argue that there were also...
It can be done by operation of law.
Sorry, Judge?
Waiver can be done by operation of law.
But as this court said...
How do you distinguish Robinson?
I'm sorry?
How do you distinguish this court's decision in Robinson?
Judge, I'm drawing a blank. If you can give me two lines, I'm sure
it'll
come back to me.
In Robinson, we decided 10 months ago that Rule 311 is, in fact, a situation where there, as we stated, unambiguously constitutes waiver. So this is a 311 case. We just said that it unambiguously constitutes waiver. So how are you distinguishing
it? Well, I would distinguish it in two ways. One is, while I would certainly agree with the court that the appellant's counsel below did not particularize the objection as well as he certainly could have, we believe that having objected to the scope of the search and having objected to the seizure of the items from his home, that...
But how is that providing any guidance whatsoever to the military judge? How is that going to play out in future cases if we simply say that an objection covers everything?
Well, Your Honor, I think that there are two ways. One is that the military judge still has a responsibility as a gatekeeper and under the plain error rule as evidence comes in, and if you recall, during the 39A session, a lot of the information that came in as it relates to whether or not there was a nexus came out for the first time, arguably, during the cross-examination of Agent Kessler. So I think that the court is certainly on firm ground to say, you know, government, you've got the burden of proving beyond a reason, of proving, you know, that the good faith exception exists, and therefore, you know, the evidence that was developed at trial is your responsibility, not the appellant's.
So the CCA was wrong when the CCA said it was raised for the first time on appeal?
We disagree with that assessment.
What
we
about the fact that at trial the appellant explicitly stated that his challenge was unconcerned with the laptop?
I understand, Your Honor.
So he was carving that out.
That's
what you're, at both the CCA and here, that's what your argument is founded on. So how can you say that it was not waived under 311 in Robinson?
Your Honor, he didn't. When he said that we are not concerned with the laptop, my recollection of the record is that he said because nothing was found on the laptop. That was his understanding at the time. So, in other words, I think he said specifically there were no pictures found on the laptop. So, when the comment that nothing was seized from the laptop, we believe was referring to the fact that there were no pictures seized from the laptop.
So, where do you cite in the record anything where, at the trial, the accused was talking about law enforcement using his computer to unlock his iPhone? Where is that in the record that I could find?
It is not, Judge.
So it's not there?
It is not.
So, again, I go back to my fundamental point. This is a 311 case. In Robinson 10 months ago, we said 311, if you don't raise the issue, it is not forfeiture, it is waiver. So how do you get past that?
We get past it, Your Honor, because we believe that I'm not going to try and defend the fact that it was inarticulately drafted at the trial level. We believe
inarticulately or absently?
I'm going with inarticulately. if I can say that word again, yes. I'm going to say that it was not articulated well. That's much better.
Well, I think we can all agree on that.
That's much better with my public school education than trying to use the fancy words, Judge.
Yeah.
But Judge Olson, we believe that it was broad enough that the military judge was on notice that the seizure from the home was being contested. And therefore, I think it would be unreasonable to believe that an appellant who is attacking the search itself would not attack a particular, and obviously germane part of that search, would make the intentional decision to relinquish that right. So I believe it goes then to forfeiture, and we look at the plain error rule.
Counsel, can I ask you a question along the same lines?
Yes, sir.
I mean, isn't the reason why the judge asked the defense counsel at trial specifically what he wanted to contest on the motion, isn't there a reason for doing that? I mean, the judge wants, the government at the trial has the burden, right? So don't they need to know what their burden is in order to carry it? And doesn't the judge need to know exactly what is being contested on the motion so that he or she can write detailed enough findings?
I would certainly agree, Judge. But again, I think in this case, the reasoning for that question was made clear, or the reasoning for the defense counsel's answer was that there was nothing seized from the computer, so he was not contesting what was seized from the computer, in terms of pictures.
But that's not what he said. He said they had no concern with the computer.
Well, I believe that there are, Judge, I'd have to look at the exact parts of, I'll check back to the transcript, but there are parts
words
in which he
to
says,
that effect.
I'm sorry, Judge?
Words to that
There were
effect.
Words to that effect, yes. And there were words that came out that said because nothing, no, there were no photos found on the computer. Judge, again, would I have done it differently? You bet. Do I think it was done well enough? And that this court then should look at the case from a plain error standpoint? I do.
But in order to look at it from a plain error standpoint, we'd have to rely on the military judge's findings to determine, first of all, the first prong of plain error, which is whether there was error, right?
Well, but
how could you do that if the judge hasn't?
We do that from, and it's Judge Ryan's dissent in Harcrow that sort of gets us over that hump by saying since Nieto was decided after the fact, we have to sort of create this legal fiction that Nieto was the law at the time of the appeal, or at the time of trial, excuse me. and that the appellant would have relinquished a known right, knowing that Nieto has now said that there has to be a substantial nexus between the items seized and the evidence produced at trial.
Right, but don't defense lawyers often raise issues knowing what the law is? I mean, they pick their issue and that's how they proceed. Isn't that how most defense lawyers work? I mean, you're a defense lawyer.
It's certainly the way I do business, Judge. But again, I think that the fact that Nieto was decided after the fact enables this court to look at it from as if Nieto was the law at the time of the appeal.
Right, but how are we confident enough to know that the military justice or that the military judge's findings apply to that aspect of the issue?
Well, we don't, which is why certainly one of the options for this court is to order a Dubay hearing or a fact-finding hearing to determine to further develop the facts in this case.
Right, but that would be happening every time this happened, wouldn't it? Every time a defense lawyer decided to be more broad or not so specific, we'd end up doing Dubay hearings, wouldn't we?
Well, but only when the law has changed since the time of trial, as it has in this case.
Right, but it wasn't a paradigm shift or anything, was it? A defense lawyer would have known that this is an aspect of the case he or she wanted to contest, wouldn't it?
Well, but conversely, Judge, you would then have to say that knowing that he would intentionally relinquish what is a very strong argument, and we would argue that he would not intentionally do so. And, you know, again, I'm not the one who wrote the brief before the Army Court.
I understand.
But the appellant's counsel himself said that this court could then look at it from the question of a Strickland v. Washington standard.
All right.
Is not what we are here, you know, that's not my lead-off argument, but it is certainly one of the fallbacks.
That's not an issue we grant.
I understand, Judge, and I can't believe my time is up very quickly, but subject to any further questions from the members of the court? Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Good morning, Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court. I'm Captain Meredith Picard, and along with my co-counsel, Major Hannah Kaufman, I represent the United States. This court should affirm the findings and sentence of the trial court because the military judge did not abuse her discretion when she denied appellant's suppression motion.
What is the government's position on waiver?
Your Honor, the government argued in its brief that our position on waiver is that this was not a knowing and voluntary relinquishment of a known right. And that is simply because in this case, appellant did file a suppression motion, and while broad and, as you've already noted, inarticulately stated, the appellant attempted to suppress all of the evidence from appellant's home and his iPhone.
Is that enough?
Enough for forfeiture, Your Honor, to preserve the issue?
Well, succinctly articulated. I mean, no, is that enough? Is that enough? Is simply throwing a pot of paint at the wall and hoping something sticks enough to stick? You know, you gave me the government's position on waiver, which is, it's not waiver. And the CCA seems to have said something else.
Yes, Your Honor. The CCA found waiver in this case because
right.
The unique argument of the linking between the laptop and the iPhone was...
Well, that's exactly what we're asking about. The nexus argument, the linking argument, which wasn't raised at all.
Your Honor, the government agrees that it wasn't raised before the appellate argument at the CCA. However,
or at trial.
Correct, Your Honor. And because of that, our facts are not developed on that issue. For example, the agent who testified about the linking of the device.
So why are we here?
Why isn't Robinson completely dispositive of this issue in the government's favor? And yet the government didn't cite Robinson in its brief.
Your Honor,
I'm perplexed. Please explain that to me.
Your Honor, certainly this court could determine this case based on waiver. The government felt that because of the granted issues in this case, one being waiver and the other being application of good faith and the military judge's decision, that the safest route was to observe the fact that the appellant did actually file a suppression motion in this case, and while it was broad, he did attempt to suppress all of the evidence.
So let's walk through this for a minute, though. The CCA says it's waived. It was never raised below. We've got Robinson from 10 months ago, where this court explicitly stated that unambiguously, 311, if it wasn't raised below, then it's waiver. So I truly am perplexed why the government is not taking that position that would win the day for the government on this issue. And more importantly, would be consistent with the binding precedent of this court.
Your Honor,
put me down as perplexed as well, like Maimonides. Go ahead.
Your Honor, again, certainly the government agrees this court could determine this case based on a waiver. But on the chance that this court determined that it wanted to look at this case under the plain error analysis as a forfeiture because of appellant's broadly stated motion.
That doesn't say anything, counsel. The question is, you had it handed to you below, and you said, oh, dear, you know, look that horse, don't look that horse in the mouth. We're going to skate around that and take the safe course. Is that it? I mean, what you said earlier seems to indicate that you were scared of this, or the government's scared of this in some way.
No, Your Honor, not scared of this. Certainly waiver would have been the easier route for the government. But this court has held on other occasions that where our rules say waiver, at times they mean forfeiture. And we wanted to be prepared for that if this court actually embraced the broad motion filed by appellant on suppression, and if this court wanted to address
That's all well and good, but that's not really responsive to Judge Olson's question.
Would you agree that if we disagree with you about the waiver issue, that we don't need to answer the first question?
Yes, Your Honor, certainly. Yes, Your Honor.
Can I ask a different question, and it's not really related to the issue, but if someone tells you, no, you can't, I'm not going to unlock my phone, can the government then go essentially unlock the phone by using their computer? So it's sort of like if I said, no, you can't come in my house at the door, can the police then enter through the window?
Yes, Your Honor.
They could?
Yes, Your Honor. So... the Supreme Court has addressed this issue of not the lawfulness of a search and seizure, but the lawfulness of the access. And recently in 2006 said in Hudson v. Michigan, we have never held that evidence is fruit of the poisonous tree simply because it would not have come to light but for illegal actions of the police. And then in that opinion, the court goes on to analyze not just the lawfulness of the search, but the lawfulness of the access. And in Your Honor's example, I think what would be similar in this case is a hypothetical where you have lawful search warrant to search a home, but no access to the home. And law enforcement realizes there's a garage attached to the home. And law enforcement also believes that they have lawful access to a vehicle. And when they search the vehicle, they find nothing. But they do find a garage door opener in the vehicle and assume, because of their knowledge of that technology, that the garage door opener will probably open the garage, and that, like most good Americans, that appellant probably doesn't lock the door between the home and the garage. In that case, I think law enforcement would have lawfully accessed the home that they had probable cause to search by using the garage door opener, because they're making an inference, but it's a permissible inference. It's not an inference about a generalized profile of a sexual offender or a particular type of person. It's an inference about the fact that a garage door opener will probably open the garage and probably they'll be able to access the home that way. That's kind of what we have in this case.
That's a good analogy. But what is the legal authority for that, for concluding that that's permissible?
Your Honor, I think the legal authority is that the Supreme Court has told us over and over again that the exclusionary rule should only be applied in cases where we have significant culpable behavior by law enforcement that must be deterred. When law enforcement is using what they consider to be common knowledge and their understanding of technology to attempt to close the pieces of an investigation, and still doing that under the advice of a military magistrate or another person authorized to issue an authorization, the evidence that's yielded through their good faith efforts should not be suppressed, because the social costs are very high. And as the court told us in hearing, while some deterrence of poor conduct or something that could have been better might be sufficient for a court to apply the exclusionary rule.
Okay. Following up on Judge Maggs, you've got a double inference here. Inference one is the garage door, you know, leave aside whether you should have been in the car or not. Assume arguendo you can get into the car. Here's a garage door opener. It's not, it's sitting on the seat in plain view. You say, aha. But the second inference is that nobody locks his back door to the garage. And I think that's a little, because if one's house is one's castle constitutionally, whether the door's locked or not.
Your Honor, in this case, that part of the analogy would, I think, apply to Special Agent Pugliese's determination that the two devices were, in fact, linked. And he made that determination incident to what he believed was a lawful search. He explained that it was actually a file folder that he found on the laptop that he found incident to what he believed was within the scope of the search authorization. And it was a file folder that showed that it was actually synchronized to the iPhone. And then he didn't find the same videos that he found on the laptop on the iPhone, which led him to the conclusion that they'd originated on the iPhone, but were actually only being stored on the laptop at that point. So his discovery of the garage door opener in our incident case came about as a result of the search he was conducting, which he believed was in the scope of the magistrate's authorization. So he only really had to make one inference, and that was that those devices probably were synchronized, because in 2014, an iPhone 4S, that is what those law enforcement agents knew about that technology. They knew that that
probably... Okay, you're getting close to the edge of losing me. Not because of the variety, not because of your argument, but because I don't know enough about syncing.
Your Honor, I think that's part of the problem in this case. I don't think the military magistrate did either. And I think 5 years later, we all know a little bit more. Just
not
like
me.
Yes, Your Honor?
Yeah, I know. It means you could send...
Yes, Your Honor, but I think also what's important in this case is that the law enforcement agent believed that not only could these devices wirelessly talk to each other, but that other devices could possibly download the things that were uploaded by the iPhone to the cloud.
Well, does that mean that every electronic device in his house is fair game for search?
That is what law enforcement reasonably believed, and that's why the government believes there was a substantial basis. And I want to make that distinction because appellant argued that the government conceded there's no substantial basis.
Did the government concede or not that there wasn't any probable cause?
Yes, Your Honor.
Government conceded that. Okay. Right. Government is saying, yeah, there wasn't any probable cause. But the government in good faith or the folks in good faith, it doesn't make any difference.
I think, Your Honor, that there's some distinction between substantial basis to determine probable cause and probable cause. If not, I don't think that particular language would have been chosen by the Supreme Court in Gates. There's some space between an actual good determination of probable cause.
Well, I mean, the government concedes there wasn't probable cause.
Yes, Your Honor.
Does the government, however, maintain that there was substantial basis for probable cause, even though there wasn't any probable cause? What are you saying?
For purposes of MRE 311, Your Honor, the government's position is that there was a substantial basis to determine probable cause in the eyes of the law enforcement officers who were executing this search and seizure.
Well, the law enforcement officers, they don't determine probable cause. The magistrate does.
Yes, Your Honor.
So, I mean, what's the relevance of that? What primrose path are you trying to lead us down?
Simply that under MRA 311, Your Honor, as this court is instructed in Carter, it is the view of the law enforcement officer and their reasonable belief in the determination of probable cause that we look at on appeal.
Well, it's not the reasonable belief in the determination of probable cause. It's the reasonable belief in the legitimacy of the search authorization.
Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, you may say that implies that they reasonably believe there was probable cause, but it's not the same thing.
Yes, Your Honor. And in this case, the government's position is that that's exactly what happened. And while the connection that law enforcement inferred would exist between the two devices and potentially other devices, while that is not a substantial enough factual basis, as this court instructed in Nieto, in order to get to probable cause, it is not entirely unreasonable that a law enforcement officer would believe it to be. And that language, entirely unreasonable, is the Supreme Court's language. It's extreme, but it's used for that reason, I think, because it has to be so unreasonable that a law enforcement officer would be checking his own work and would be second-guessing a military magistrate, a judge, a person with the authority to grant that authorization. Here, law enforcement told the magistrate everything that he knew about the case, what he believed was true about the technology at that time that was involved, and she determined that there was probable cause. So it's not entirely unreasonable that he would believe that was enough. So it's the government's position that if this court does want to address the issue of appellant's laptop being used to unlock his iPhone, this court can also find, as the Army Court did, that the laptop was seized in good faith by law enforcement and that using it to unlock appellant's iPhone does not create fruit of the poisonous tree, but simply was an access route for the government to unlock evidence that they had probable cause to search. Pending this court's questions.
Counsel, you've discussed waiver. Going to your forfeiture argument, I understand that maybe we don't get to forfeiture, but Mr. Cacera said that if it is reviewed under forfeiture, that we should find plain error because at the time of the motion, the Nieto case was not yet decided. What is your response to that?
Your Honor, I don't think that the Nieto case changed the law. I think that the Nieto case was clarification and restatement of the fact that there must be a factual nexus between person, place, and the offense alleged in order to find probable cause. I think the Nieto case surprised some people, but it didn't change the law. So I don't think that we have to look at this with a factual fiction, that this, you know, was the law at the time. It was the law at the time. But I think in this case, looking at this nuanced argument between the two devices being unlocked by reverse engineering their connection is such a nuanced argument that it's unreasonable to assume a military judge would identify that sua sponte. You can imagine a case where suppression motion is filed and there is something so egregious that a military judge would, in assessing the facts, potentially make a ruling based on something that was not specifically articulated by defense counsel. But in this case, it's so nuanced that there's not a chance that the military judge would have addressed this issue, particularly because she found the laptop was seized in good faith. So because there are only two pages in the record that actually address how that was done, it's unlikely that she would have identified the issue. It's certainly not plain or obvious.
Major Picard, what about defense counsel's position on the Hoffman case? The last part of Hoffman, the last paragraph, I think, this court dismisses the notion that there is any good faith, that the good faith exception did not apply. But he sees that as, you can correct me if I'm wrong when you get up on rebuttal, but he says that that's now the state of the law. But I'm not sure how I can determine that when the court didn't really say very much.
Your Honor, the government agrees. Our position is that Hoffman is wholly distinguishable because for multiple reasons, Hoffman was not a good faith case. This court declined to go into a lengthy description of why it rejected the good faith doctrine in that case, but simply inferring from prior decisions and precedent, there are four examples of cases that would forfeit the good faith presumption in a search warrant case, and the government believes that at least two of them existed in Hoffman. So the government's position is Hoffman is fully reconcilable with Carter. This court simply didn't go into a lengthy description or cite Carter. And the term substantial basis as used in Hoffman potentially isn't clarified or discussed, but I don't think that those cases, I don't think that this court necessarily needs to do anything with either of those cases if it declines to do so, because Hoffman simply is not a good faith case. There's no discussion of it.
Thank you.
Pending further questions, the government asks that this court affirm the findings and sentence of the trial judge.
Thank you, counsel. Does the appellant have rebuttal?
Thank you, members of the court. Judge Alston, instead of just ignoring the large white elephant in the room, I'd like to just point the court's attention to JA at page 19. In which the civilian defense counsel does say that with regards to the evidence we're speaking of, there are a series of videos that were recovered from the cell phone that was initially seized by Master Sergeant Clark and ultimately searched by CID. With regards to the other digital media that was seized, In looking at the charge sheet, no other evidence was recovered from that digital media that's appearing on the charge sheet. That the only evidence that we're talking about appeared from the iPhone. So that was the quote that I was sort of trying to remember in my brain, and I did want to point it out through the court. Your Honors, I'd like to address Captain Picard's argument with regards to Carter v. Hoffman and with regards to the nexus. The problem in this case is not the lack of a sufficient nexus. The problem with the case is that there is a lack of any nexus between the affidavit and the information sought to be seized. So, Judge Sparks, with regards to your question, as I stated earlier, we do not believe that this court has to overrule Carter. We believe that the two cases are entirely reconcilable. Well, that's the second big word I've used.
I think your reconciliation appears to be different from the government's, isn't it?
It does. I think that their position in their brief was that in looking at the two of them, that Carter is the better statement of the law, and we would say that Hoffman is the better statement of the law, but there may be two sides to the same coin. I don't think that the court needs to take any action as it relates to Carter or Hoffman in order to reach a decision in this case.
That's it.
So I would like to point out a couple of things. First, going back to that question, Judge Barks, we believe that even under Carter, that there was no basis for probable cause, and therefore this court can affirm under either of those theories. And then I'd like to talk very briefly about the scope of the authorization. Special Agent Puglisi's search exceeding the scope, the authorized scope. The agent was told that he had the authority to search for pictures, video, emails, documents, and text related to sexual misconduct. The agent said that he thought that he was looking for evidence related to that offense or other sexual misconduct. Notably absent from that was a search for the file that would allow him to open up the iPhone. At no point was there anything in the search authorization, either in the affidavit or in the authorization, authorizing the search of a key to, and the Army Court talks much about a key and analogizes this to a physical key. We would disagree with that analogy, but we would say that the good faith exception does not apply where the willful and purposeful actions of the agent in exceeding the scope of the search authorization are not objectively reasonable. In this case, they were not. And searching for the key to unlock the iPhone exceeded the scope of the warrant, which authorized searching for pictures, videos, emails, documents, and text related to other sexual misconduct. That concludes the appellant's presentation, subject to any further questions from the members of the court.
Thank you, counsel.
Always a pleasure, Judge. Thank you.
Court thanks counsel for both sides. Case is now submitted. And the court will be in recess until 10:20.
Court stands in recess until 10:20.